Hello, America and the world. This is Radio Free Market, and I am your guest host, Aaron Brown, sitting in today for Michael McKay. We are behind the lines of socialism, my friends, and Radio Free Market is the voice of free people and free markets. Our topic today is Planned Poverty, the Gift of Government Intervention. I first want to welcome our special guest, Jeffrey Tucker. Hello, Mr. Tucker.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
I'm honored to interview you. Mr. Tucker is the editorial vice president of the Ludwig von Mises Institute and the current webmaster for the Institute's website, Mises.org. Tucker is also an adjunct scholar with the McKinnick Center for Public Policy and an Acton University faculty member. He also wrote a book called Bourbon for Breakfast, which is an awesome book, and I highly recommend it. It's free on Mises.org, which again is Mises.org. So this show is based on the speech that Mr. Tucker gave at the Mises Institute called The Decivilizing Effects of Government. And you led off by talking about the difference between older socialists and new ones, saying that the old socialists argued for socialism because they believed, mistakenly or not, that socialism would bring about higher standards of living. For example, Marx wanted to relieve the conditions of the poor. The New Deal sought to improve the standards of living of the United States. Now, you say that modern socialists seem to want a lower standard of living and to use government intervention to bring it about. Can you elaborate on that?
It's almost a charming thing to read the old socialists because they didn't have any of what we associate with modern progressivist mentality. You know, they wanted progress. They wanted the world to be fed. They wanted technological development. You know, I mean, Lenin and Stalin wanted to electrify all of Russia. So, you know, I mean, they were in favor of industry. They favored socialism because they thought it would be good for the world. Of course, that didn't turn out to be true. It was exactly the opposite. It impoverished every place that tried it. But what's strange to me, and I can't say I entirely understand it. It's almost like socialism is a sort of a religion. Rather than give up socialism, it's as if the left changed its ideals. So now, and I think this has been true for several decades now, you get this kind of romance of poverty among the left, and it's a pervasive attitude. People wanting to sort of go back to nature and get rid of industrial society and grow your own vegetables and have a compost pile up back rather than using the local trash service or whatever the thing is. So I guess what I'm saying here, and these are all to my mind, this longing for a kind of Rousseauian poverty where we're all kind of happy without material goods is very dangerous when it's instituted in a government policy, which it is, and it is bringing about poverty. So what I'm suggesting is that once the socialists saw what their policies actually bring about, they changed their goals. You know, rather than prosperity, the goal is now to make us all live with less.
Mm-hmm. And that's a good segue into the next, you know, point is that you wrote that Rousseau kind of romanticized the idea of the hunter-gatherer society and local trade, and you know, to me it kind of sounds like we'd be thrust back into the barter system, and our Radio Free Market listeners know that barter is extremely inefficient. It would most likely lead to you know, not even jokingly, would probably lead to mass death and an extreme decline in the standard of living of every single person on the planet.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the invention of money, which is a market innovation, it came about because it made exchange more efficient and allowed us to cooperate with ever more people in the division of labor. Money is nothing other than a kind of a proxy for goods and services that allows you to calculate profits and losses and make sense of your economic life. So it was a market innovation. But yes, I think you're right. I mean, many people on the left, you know, sort of had this romantic attachment to the idea of barter and making your own stuff. And, you know, I've done some research on this thing because I can't entirely understand where this comes from, but there is a many intellectuals out there and many political activists who really do think they believe that.
I'm sorry to interrupt real quick. We're coming close to the end of this first segment. We will be back with Jeffrey Tucker on his article called The Decivilizing Effects of Government. Please stay with us. Hello, America and the world. We're back on Radio Free Market. And, Jeffrey, I'm going to let you finish that thought on kind of the leftist romanticization of kind of hunter-gatherer society and lower standards of living.
Sure. There are many best-selling books on this topic. They imagine that the market economy or industrial society or modernity, as we understand it, is unsustainable. So it's all going to crash and burn, you know, in the old Marxist fantasy that somehow capitalism is going to unwind and collapse. And so we have to, you know, now look forward to a future of doing without. And they have elaborate schemes for how we're going to travel without cars and how we're all going to be growing our own vegetables and our streets can be turned into
rain collectors, right?
Yeah. It's all just kind of insane. But and of course, there are always crazy people in the world, and we understand that. But look, the problem here is that this point of view is being subtly written into the laws that are running our society. So, you know, there's a whole host of ways in which government is kind of unraveling what the market is trying to unravel, what the market has created. And you see it in your daily lives and your appliances in your home that don't work and the toilets that don't flush well and the water that's not running as well as it used to in your home. These are all consequences of government regulations. Not that people understand this, but it's just true. You know, every government regulation
And off to our listeners, you're going to love hearing about the examples Jeff gave about things like toilets, bed bugs, things like that. But before we get into that, you know, some of the when I was at Mises University, I had some interesting conversations with, you know, with some of the students there, talking about how we could connect with the right and connect with the left. And it's interesting because, you know, there's this, as you say, there's this drive for sustainability and local, you know, local, grow your food and have your own garden. You know, if you understand economics, capitalism is the only sustainable system. It's the only way to allocate scarce resources, to not waste it. And through the price system, we know, you know, if tomatoes are $1 million, then guess what? Someone's eating too many tomatoes or, you know, however the price system coordinates that information. So if you understand economics, we could kind of, you know, we could connect people with the left on that if they would just kind of understand that it's unsustainable. It has nothing to do with capitalism. It has to do with government intervention.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, and the area of business cycle research in particular shows how monetary inflation creates unsustainable, you know, bubbles and things. But yeah, what troubles me, I guess, most about so many people today is that, you know, we live in this world of unbelievable prosperity, and yet people fail to appreciate the cause and effect relationships that are giving us this prosperity. We take it all for granted, you know. I mean, there's some people who walk into Walmart, and instead of seeing a miracle like I see, which is, it really is a miracle, I mean, it conforms to the vision of heaven of many world religions, you know, I mean, from all time. And yet they look at it and go, oh, look at this disgusting display of materialism, you know. And, well, okay, my view is if you don't like materialism, fine. You don't like Walmart, don't shop there, you know. But why deny millions and millions, hundreds of millions of poor people access to a fantastic array of goods and products and food and things at low prices that would have been unthinkable, mm-hmm. You know,
and you know,
50 years ago,
yeah.
Say nothing of 1,500 years ago.
Mm-hmm. And you know, when people get upset at Walmart, I guess I can understand where they're coming from. I think they might be misguided because they put out mom and pop shops. Kind of what I try to say is, look, I don't think Walmart is bad, but even if you do, be mad at the fact that maybe the reason these mom-and-pop shops don't survive is because they have to comply with a whole host of rules and regulations. They get their faces taxed off. They get taxed through monetary inflation. So, you know, don't be mad at Walmart. Maybe you should be mad at the government that's making it very hard for smaller businesses to survive in this regulatory environment.
Well, that, you know, I think you raise an interesting point. It's very difficult to do counterfactuals on these kinds of problems. But if you talk to any small business owner today, I mean, just schedule a dinner with one of these men or women and find out about the kind of frustrations they feel. You know, it's they're anxious to serve customers, they're anxious to make good products and bring them to people, but the biggest problems they have are high taxes, government regulations. Makes it almost impossible to hire new employees. Child labor laws are egregious. The minimum wages. I mean, hardly anybody seems to be talking about this stuff anymore. But you know, they've gone up so much in the last 5 years, in real terms and in nominal terms, that it's priced all young people out of the labor market. So the small businesses can't even get employees anymore. They have to pay these exorbitant wages, and
heard. It might just be hearsay, but I live in California, mm-hmm. and one of my capitalist pig friends told me that they were thinking either it was in the works or they were thinking about of raising the minimum wage to $10 in California, and that could be completely untrue. You know, it might just be hearsay, but I thought that was insane. But I want to ask you about this guy named David Holmgren, who you cited in your article, and this is a guy, he's an author from Australia for our listeners to know, and he writes that technology has been on the wrong track for 500 years.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's right. That's
he
right.
said 500 years ago, when there were 500 million people on the planet, where I can talk to Jeffrey Tucker all the way across the country, 500 years ago, again, there were 500 million people on the planet. So I find that kind of self-explanatorily frightening, to be honest, that
right.
this guy is pining for 500 years ago. So I'll let you go at it. Just elaborate on what this guy said.
Well, they don't. It's typical of these people that they don't imagine what the implications of what their thought really are. I mean, a technology of 500 years ago is capable of sustaining a population level of 500 years ago and no more. And you pretty much have to kill off everybody else. If you're going to sustain a global population of 7 billion people, on the other hand, you've got to have very sophisticated, very advanced markets just to keep people clothed, fed, and housed. Otherwise, people are going to die off. And look, our lifespans have been expanding dramatically, mostly since the Gilded Age. You know, for all of recorded human history, the average lifespan was between 25 and 35 years. You know, that included a ton of child deaths and was not untypical for most families to have, two out of three kids die before the age of five. You know, that was just normal. And now, you know, when we know people that this happens to, it's a profound and an unusual tragedy. But early death was the plight of humanity for most all of human history. But if you're talking about sustaining 7 billion people at any one time and having lifespans that stretch into the 70s and 80s, you know, you've got to have an extremely sophisticated, market-provided industrial apparatus that is global in nature.
Mm-hmm.
And no amount of romantic attachments to the way things used to be 500 years ago, whatever, is going to change that.
Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed your humor when you were talking about this guy, because you wrote that, David Holmgren criticizing his advocacy. You wrote criticizing his advocacy of local trade and disuse of technology and the division of labor. And you wrote, perhaps there is one benefit to his plan. There's no question that once it is implemented, David Holmgren would no longer be a best-selling author.
Oh, that's
and
for sure.
So comment on this quote, because it's humorous, but there's some real truth and important implications to it that I don't think this guy would even thought about.
It's very difficult to understand how these people don't connect things. I mean, I saw this guy's lecture, in some idyllic garden in Australia or whatever, on YouTube. You know, a technology didn't even exist 5 years ago. I mean, I can watch it on my handheld computer, something that wouldn't have been possible 2 years ago. So, yeah, I mean, they're using all the modern tools, even while they condemn them. And these people really have it's a kind of a religious fantasy. And I must say that the global warming hysteria, which I now I should change that. It's no, they no longer warns about global
That's
warming.
Cooling, right? Yeah.
Well, it's a climate change. Just to
climate
kind
change.
Of,
yes,
to make sure that we're safe on both
all.
Ends of that. Yeah, climate change. But this is also just a kind of a myth spun out of a kind of left wing paranoia. That somehow Mother Nature is going to strike back at us for having abused her, or and invented the the automobile or, mm-hmm. you know, the internal combustion engine or, you know, for extracting oil from Mother Earth or whatever kind of nutty.
mm-hmm. You know what, and to that, there's a group of people who have that exact, this kind of romantic point of view and the idea, like you were just saying, that Mother Earth is going to strike back at us for being naughty, naughty little planet stewards. if any of our listeners are interested, go online and type in Venus Project Stefan Molyneux debate. And Molyneux is spelled Molyneux. And I just watched this 2 days ago. It's a two-hour debate, and this guy just it's just a great debate. And I don't know why that just popped up in my head, because they were talking about you know, the idea that Mother Earth is going to strike back, and Stefan Molyneux is an Austrian. It was just a fantastic debate.
But he's very articulate. I enjoy his material.
He's fantastic, and I just came on to him just not too long ago, and my friend was clamoring at me for so long to do it, and I was just like, yeah, go jump in the lake. But then, you know, because I'm pretty satisfied, you know, reading Mises.org and Lou Rockwell and some other sites, but, I mean, he's fantastic. And we have about a minute left, but I'm going to let you get started on this question. Your article cites some interesting real-world examples, and I think this is a great show for our listeners, because you're going to be able to put the accumulated economic knowledge that you have now from listening to our shows, and you're going to be able to see some really great real-world examples of how what the government does in an attempt to make things better just completely messes everything up. And you wrote that the government war on really everything, medicine, chemicals, food, drink, sector after sector. They just keep intervening everywhere. And the incandescent light bulb was your first example. And we're going to discuss what the government has done to the incandescent light bulb right after we come back, because we're coming close to the end of this break. So please stay with us on RadioFreeMarket.com. We're here with Jeffrey Tucker talking about planned poverty. Please stay with us. Hello, America. We are back on Radio Free Market. We're here with Dr. Jeffrey Tucker. Is it doctor or is it Mr.?
No, it's just Mr.
Sir Jeffrey Tucker?
Lord Tucker, right.
Lord Tucker, Lord Privy Tucker. So I'll just let you go at it. Tell us, what has the government done to the incandescent light bulb?
Yeah, we can start there. Some as they used to say in the 1950s, pointy-headed bureaucrat, you know, had the idea that fluorescent bulbs are more efficient because they put out much more light relative to heat, whereas incandescent bulbs put out, you know, mostly heat rather than light. And from the point of view of the central planners, it's like a no-brainer. We've got to phase out the incandescent and make everybody use these fluorescent bulbs. Well, it turns out that a room full of fluorescent bulbs can be totally oppressive. I mean, inconceivably oppressive, and the fluorescent bulbs don't have the same kind of light. It's sort of light, but it's not really light. It's very troubling on the eye and on the brain, and make your Christmas trees look stupid. And you know, a house full of these things, you just want to. At least for me, maybe it doesn't affect everybody this way, but I'd rather walk around in the dark than deal with these awful things. And, you know, they did this in Germany. I think this whole movement against the incandescent bulbs started in Europe. They phased them out completely in Germany, and the public just went crazy with these new bulbs. And so lots of new companies have started marketing the old incandescent bulbs as heat balls. They call them heat balls, mm-hmm. and now they're very popular, and people buy heat balls that you can screw in and use.
Oh,
so there's like this, you know, they had to reinvent them and sell them basically in the gray market in order to please the customers. And this is what's happening in the U.S. I mean, this is a kind of and I've thought about this a lot, this question of, well, what is this idea of efficiency? So some bureaucrat in Washington is going to tell us what's efficient. Well, you know, what's efficient from their point of view may not be from our point of view. They have decided that that a bulb shouldn't put out heat. Well, who's to say? You know, who's to say a bulb shouldn't also put out heat? And maybe the heat is essential to making the light gentle, functional, beautiful, livable. You know,
mm-hmm. You wrote that, you know, if it were true that the fluorescent lighting is better and it consumes a fraction of the energy, well, then by definition, it just seems like it's a better product. And would there be a reason to use violence at all to keep this product off the market. Of course,
right, we love
it's
better
ridiculous.
Product. We love better and better things all the time, so there wouldn't be any force necessary. So the fact that they're having to install this in a government regulation, first of all, it implies that somehow there's a market failure at work, which there is not a market failure. I mean, consumers are smart enough to know what kind of bulbs they want to buy. And it secondly, it implies that they understand that consumers would much rather have old-fashioned bulbs than the new ones. And I'm starting to get worried about this, and I know a lot of people are stockpiling the old incandescent bulbs because they can't live with these fluorescent things. And I understand that. Every time I go to the hardware store and I run across these other bulbs, I feel the impulse to want to stock up too. I don't know if
it's kind
too
of a
early.
Creepy doctor's office, you know, CIA, like CIA, you know, interrogation room light. It's very kind of creepy.
Well, I've stared at these fluorescent bulbs for a very long time and looked at them and seen their effects on a room on what it does to like a page when you're trying to read it or on when they're on a Christmas tree. It's hard to put your finger on exactly what it is, but the light doesn't spread. It's like a lit-up thing, but it doesn't quite pervade the room in the same way. It's very difficult for me to put my finger on exactly what's wrong with them. And you notice that there's many, many headlights that are now being made with fluorescent lighting. I assume this is also a response to government regulations. And it drives me crazy when a car comes up behind me with those fluorescent lights. I mean,
those aren't halogens, are they? Is that completely different?
Yeah, I don't really know a lot about the technology, but
I don't know.
Which I should. I mean, I should look into them and figure out what's going on. But you can see it on the highway. Some cars, when they're coming up behind you, their lights don't bother you, and some are very intense and they sort of drill through your brain. So this is another area of research. I'd like to look into this and talk to a car manufacturer and find out what's going on here. Mm-hmm. But this is only the tip of the iceberg. I mean, you know, in terms of household products that have been, you know, virtually destroyed by government regulations. You know, the flow of water through our homes, which we think of as being essential to civilization, you know, indoor plumbing. We look back at civilizations and go, well, do they have indoor plumbing or not? I mean, that's a big deal. Well, regulations are making our plumbing work less and less well because they're forcing subdivisions to turn down the water pressure in the name of saving water. And that's ruining our appliances. They're imposing all kind of government regulations on things like dishwashers and clothes washers so that they'll use less electricity, use less water. And guess what? Oh, and also, of course, the water's not nearly as hot because they're destroying our hot water heaters, too. Guess what? Clothes aren't getting clean. Dishes are not coming out clean anymore. This is affecting every aspect of life of our homes. And little by little, so we don't always notice it, except like one day we wake up and go, well, why are my socks kind of stinky? You know, why is that? You know, maybe it's the detergent I'm using. Oh, and I don't want to even get into detergents because they've also messed up. But everything's connected. You know, they change the water pressure. They regulate the amount of water your appliances can use. They screw around with your hot water heater, so now the hot water doesn't get as hot anymore. You have to hack it.
We're coming close to the end. We have about 30 seconds left in this segment, but for our listeners, you're just going to flip when we start to talk about bed bugs and how some of the things the government has done, you know, again, for the common good and just because, again, you know, they're pointy-headed bureaucrats, is that it?
Yeah, that was the 50s term, yeah.
that's fantastic. And just because they're busybodies and they just can't get enough of control, that they've you know, created an epidemic of bed bugs. And we're going to talk about that in our next segment. Please stay with us on Radio Free Market. We're here with Jeffrey Tucker talking about government intervention. Please stay with us. Hello, America. We're back on Radio Free Market with Jeffrey Tucker talking about planned poverty, the gift, the wonderful gift of government intervention. We're going to talk about plumbing. I bet you didn't think that the government could screw up toilets, but guess what? They have. So, you know, I always wondered why the toilet gets clogged up so often. It just didn't really make sense to me intuitively, even before I read your book and started reading about economics. But just when I was little, I wondered why, you know, I can fly across the darn country. I can, I can have all this insane technology. You know, I can watch TV and all these things, but the toilet gets clogged up. You know, for God's sake, I'm talking to you from all the way across the country, but I can't have a working toilet. So please explain to us why toilets stink, pun intended.
Okay, there's so many aspects to this, and it's tremendously fascinating and evil. But it all began back in the early 70s when it became very fashionable among a certain set to put a brick in your toilet. You probably don't remember this, but it was the left-wing set. So, you got to put a brick in your toilet. Why? To save water. Okay, fine, whatever. Put a brick in your toilet if you want to. Okay. Toilets were 3 and 5 gallons in those days. Well, the brick in your toilet thing slowly caught on. Sure enough, there's it was regulated. And I forget, I've got the dates in the book. I can't remember exactly when this happened. Maybe it was in the 1980s. But Congress probably inadvertently voted for a regulation that forcibly reduced toilet tank size down to 1.6 gallons, which turns out to be enough to flush some things, but not all things. And so, it became a major problem, and almost all toilets had to be redesigned, and the private manufacturers got after it, trying to reshape them to use 1.6 gallons with varying degrees of success. But ultimately, what we all ended up doing is plunging all the time. And so it's very common now that you see plungers next to toilets, which is not
gross and unsanitary.
It was not common when I was young. You never saw a plunger. I mean, you plunge a toilet once in your life or something. It was crazy. But now you got to plunge all the time because the darn things don't work, and you have to pay for the expense of replacing these toilets with better toilets. But even then, even the best of the modern toilets do not work as well as the worst of the old toilets. And this is for another key reason. While sometimes you can design them to get stuff down, you cannot design them to clean themselves well with 1.6 gallons. Now, this is an interesting thing because you have far less water running through the toilet. This has other effects. So the toilet gets dirty unless it's cleaned pretty much constantly. So you've got to kind of keep a brush in the bathroom too, which is why you go to Walmart and see a whole row full of brushes for the toilets, because you've got to have one in every bathroom. But listen, let's say you're going to be out for a week and you're not going to be able to clean your toilet. So you've got to have some kind of chemical to go into the toilet tank that's going to keep it clean. And that's why at CVS and Walmart and Kroger, you find all these little cubes of bleach that you can throw into the tank. Well, that helps keep the thing clean, but the problem is it breaks down the stopper that stops the rubber stopper that keeps the thing plugged up, and it makes it more porous, which causes it to leak. And then you hear that little sort of dripping sound. It annoys you. What's that sound? Oh, it's the toilet running. I got to replace the stopper. Well, when I was young, you never had to replace the stopper. Stopper was for life. You had a stopper in your toilet, it lasted for life. Now you got to replace them, every few months or something like that. But it gets worse. Because there's not enough water flowing through the tank, mineral deposits have developed around all the inside workings of the thing, and they begin to clog up. So you have to replace them. And if you can replace them all the time, then they might as well not be made out of steel. They'll be made out of plastic. So, all these companies have made a gazillion dollars innovating new plastic insides of toilets, and they have to be replaced every few months. So every household now has to have some sort of master of the toilet, the toilet technician. Oh, we got a problem with the toilet? No problem. Come and call me. And so you have to get down there with screwdrivers. It's unbelievably unsanitary to have to change these things out. And we all change our toilet, the insides of our toilet tanks all the time now, whereas, 30 years ago, nobody ever did that. That was the unapproachable area. That was like, you would never lift the top off the toilet tank because it's disgusting in there. You don't even want to know what's in there. Now we all know. We all know well too well, and it's a consequence of government regulation.
Not only is it just kind of unsanitary and, it's just kind of gross. I mean, I'd like to think we live in a society where you buy a toy, you don't worry about it as a part of your life. You don't really want to have to concentrate on very often, right?
Right.
But also on the economic level, look at all the resources that are wasted to correct all the problems that you cited because of a law that just says smaller tank. All the toilet companies have to buy up resources to make all these new tanks and all these.
The black markets for large toilet tanks. A few years ago, there was actually a shooting war on the Canada-U.S. border over large toilet tanks. And now you can't even get the darn things. Yeah. There's actually, and I'm sorry for going on about this topic, but, it actually is a very, very important topic. I mean, it seems kind of silly. It's very important. If you go to San Francisco today, you will notice a stink in the air, and that stink is sewage. The reason that the place stinks is because there's not enough water flowing through the sewage system to clean it out, and the place is clogging up. So that's why there's a stink. City planners, not knowing what to do about it, have decided that the best way to deal with this is the same way we deal with this at home, with a little bit of bleach, except that in the case of San Francisco, you got to use a lot of bleach, which means like tankers and tankers and tankers of bleach pouring through the sewage system. This is what they're planning to do. What the consequences are going to be on the groundwater, I guess we'll know in 5 or 10 years, but it could be very, very dangerous.
When everyone in San Francisco is white from the inside out.
Yeah, right. I mean, this is unbelievably dangerous. So you see what I mean when I talk about government unraveling civilization. I really mean it. I mean, they're taking away from us, you know.
And you know, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
You know, bugs. I like the bed bugs example is cool. And you wrote, you know, for our human history, one of our biggest enemies, so to speak, has been bugs, you know, malaria and the Black Plague, however that was, you know, spread in reality. You know, if you didn't think government intervention could cause bed bugs, folks, it does. And it can be attributed to the government banning of DDT, you say, which has been widely smeared, but has saved hundreds of millions of lives from malaria. Can you tell us how the banning of DDT has not only caused the return of malaria, but also a bed bug epidemic?
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, they stopped spraying because of a book called Silent Spring, which is just a big pack of lies from the beginning to the end. And bedbugs were just about wiped out from the face of the earth. They stopped spraying the DDT. They've gradually fought their way back. And now some people say that DDT doesn't even work against them, which may be true. The point is that the process of innovating chemicals that kill these evil, evil pests has been interrupted and stopped because of all the regulations over the process of chemical ingenuity and marketing. So now we pretty much don't have anything to kill bed bugs with. I mean, some people say DDT doesn't work anymore on them. I would like to know that for sure. You know, I mean, I would like to try them. The bed bugs are ghastly. We're talking right now in March, so it's you know, rather cold outside in most places of the country. So the bed bugs don't come out when it's cold; they go into hibernation. But come middle of spring and early summer, and then late summer, and I can promise you, this whole scandal is going to come roaring back more fiercely than ever. Last year, CNN's offices and Google's headquarters were both infested by bedbugs, and there was infestations all over the country. There was no town excepted. Some places were worse than others, and we're not talking about, you know, like flies or even roaches. We're talking about things that eat you up as you sleep, You talk about being creeped out. I mean, if you can't sleep, you can't have a normal life. And if you lie in bed thinking that the second you close your eyes and go into an absolute stillness, the bed bugs will come crawling out of the mattress and start chewing on your flesh, it's hard to go to sleep.
And you, I was telling you a little bit over the break, and this is absolutely a true story, no exaggeration. My cousin and my sister had an apartment in New York so badly infested with bed bugs that they had to move out 4 or 5 times, had it fumigated, or whatever, you know, whatever they had done. It's so bad that she had to sell her place. So, you know, and you wrote, you know, that the EPA encourages education, and the New York Times headlined the story saying that the return of bed bugs has baffled scientists, and they're just stunned, and they have no idea. And you wrote, I believe correctly, that there isn't much reason to be baffled when we have the tools, but the government prevents them from using them. And even if DDT is no longer effective, you know, the process of innovation would be able to come up with a chemical that probably works. You know, if these companies had enough profit, they could probably make up something that's incredibly safe. You know, and it wouldn't hurt you. You know,
no, that's right. But nowadays, you know, even the hardware stores carrying fewer products that work to kill bugs. I mean, you can't even buy the one product I ever found to control bugs in my backyard. I can't even find anymore at hardware stores because they don't. They're afraid to carry them because they get harassed by regulators. So I had to order mine through some surreptitious, you know, means with some fly-by-night company, whatever, that produces them and repackages them in bottles with different names. This is life in America today. Can you believe it? The U.S. of A. And and speaking of chemical products, you know that you can't buy at Home Depot anymore effective drain opening chemicals. Lye is now banned for sale.
What is
lye? And any product with lye because of the drug war or whatever kind of crazy excuse they give. So you can't unclog your drains anymore. That's just FYI. So, I mean, the consequences of all this are just gruesome. I mean, we're going to be soon living in houses with tepid water that breeds diseases, with toilets that are filthy, with beds that are filled with tiny bugs that eat your flesh, and drains that are so clogged with hair that they're spreading all kind of viruses all over the house. This is the future. This is the future that government regulators are giving us. And I compare that with the glory that capitalism, the glorious civilization that capitalism created. You know, it's a remarkable thing. It's like capitalism provides the progress, it provides the advances, it provides better lives, and then government comes along and just reverses the whole process and tries to get us to be ever more poor. And that's what I mean. That's the thesis of the book, and that's what I mean by government unraveling civilization. It's serious stuff.
Mm-hmm. And you said a couple of times during the course of this interview about tepid water, so I wanted to give you a chance to talk about that. You said that you wrote that the government suggested that citizens cure the problem of bed bugs, which they created, by washing sheets in hot water. And you wrote that's all well and good, but the government's outlawed hot water by shipping water heaters with a default setting that makes the water lukewarm.
Yeah, the default setting that they're usually shipped with is 110, in some places 120. And for now, you can find older hot water heaters where you can crank it up yourself, but you have to open up the side and unscrew the deal and then, you know, get a screwdriver in there and turn it. And if you're like me, you know, I feel like the water heater is just not something I should be fiddling with. You know, we have visions of exploding heaters or whatever. I don't know. I don't want to know anything about
hot water.
Right. But you have to in order to get your water hot, because if you're not using hot water, your stuff isn't getting clean. And 110, I'm sorry, that is E. coli water. That is not hot water.
that's like jacuzzi water. That's like, you know, that's for us. We can survive in that. You know, I mean, I'm sure the bacteria are fine. You know?
Yeah. The bugs and bacteria and viruses and evil things who just thrive at 110. You know, we don't know what the consequences of this are going to be. I think it's very scary. You know, the effects of these government regulations are always more profound and much more serious than the regulators ever imagine. And I'm getting very concerned that the combination of all of these things are going to be breeding diseases and terrible misery in the future. And then there's not going to be any going back. But you know what's shocking to me is that even in the case of, like, bed bugs, you know, when you can easily demonstrate that the thing was that the epidemic of bed bugs is a result of government regulations, you know, no bureaucrats ever consider going backwards. They don't unravel what they did in the past. They just keep kind of hitting harder, you know.
Mm-hmm. And you said that in the future the combination of all these things might cause some pretty undesirable consequences. But you know what's going to happen? There's a book for our listeners called Crisis in Leviathan by Robert Higgs, and it's not about bed bugs, but it's about the fact that when there's this kind of not really well defined desire for the government just to fix something, just fix it. Things are so bad, just do something. And so the government regulations that caused the problem in the first place, because there's going to be this kind of ill-defined public outcry for the government just to do something, and they can't really solve anything, but they're going to go, you know, they're going to go in and maybe nuke the bed bugs. Now, I'm exaggerating, but they're going to do something crazy. That's probably not going to work. They're going to make us stop eating, you know, lemons, because lemons give off a scent that attracts bed bugs. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, there was some proposed solution last year, and I'm trying to think what that is. Oh, I believe there was a congressional legislation to create. Yeah, it was a new program. It's coming back to me now. It was a new program that would be funded with millions and millions of dollars that would create. That's what it was. Inspection agencies that would inspect the apartments to make sure that they don't have bed bugs before they can go on the market. Homes have to be inspected for beds, but by congressional mandate. So you talk about making a bad situation worse. Send in the bureaucrats to inspect. You know, and what are they going to be inspecting for? I mean, it's a problem that was caused by bureaucrats in the first place. And now they're going to enforce, I don't know, they're just going to, like, wish it away through some sort of government regulation. Anyway, that was a bill that was introduced into Congress last year, and I'm sure it's going to come back again. So we could have bed bug inspections in the near future.
Fantastic. Yeah. You know, and recycling, plumbing, light bulbs, you know, these all seem like kind of trivial inconveniences that we can deal with. Although you know, they're obviously tyrannical and unnecessary inconveniences. But one of your last examples is about medicine. And you wrote about how, for example, pseudoephedrine, which is Sudafed, can no longer be purchased from the drugstore because the government outlawed it. And this is just insane. I mean, pseudoephedrine, as you wrote, the godsend for sinus trouble.
Yeah. And, you know, the implications of this are quite profound, too, because you know, the street price of pseudoephedrine is now something like 10 times what the retail price is, if you can get it. Many people, by the way, have gotten embroiled in the court system. Some have gone to jail just because they bought too much pseudoephedrine to unclog their nose because they've been technically in violation of law, although it's very difficult to know even how much you can buy. You can't buy enough to meet the standards on the package of how much you should be taking. And some people just have to have Sudafed. But in any case, the results of this big difference between the retail price and the street price is that many, many, many people are being recruited into the armies of people who are buying the stuff to make things like methamphetamine, which, you know, the government basically advertised, you know, but in banning pseudoephedrine, they advertised to everybody in the world, if you want to make money, get some pseudoephedrine and turn it into methamphetamine and sell it on the street. I mean, it's like drug promotion, not drug war. You know? So now you've got
that's such a great point. I hate to interrupt you. We're coming close to the end of this segment, but we're going to come back and talk about the government promotion for methamphetamine, which is we're talking about with Jeffrey Tucker. Please stay with us on Radio Free Market. Hello, America. We're back on Radio Free Market. Jeff, I'm going to let you finish that point on how the outlawing of pseudoephedrine has just completely expanded the methamphetamine trade.
Yes. So it used to be the making and selling of methamphetamine was limited to a small sector of society. But since putting it behind the counter and requiring driver's licenses and rationing how much you can buy, now the meth dealers have every incentive to recruit people to go to their local Walgreens or CVS and buy their monthly allotment and resell it at 10 times the price to the dealer, which gives, you know, the average person a chance to make a quick few $100, which is a great thing. So, but what's remarkable about this is that it therefore expanded the numbers of people who are involved in the sector of methamphetamine making and dealing. So you've got ever more people now embroiled in the world of drug making and drug abuse than ever before. And you know, we should also remember that methamphetamine came about only because of the war on safer drug than methamphetamine. But the crackdown on that made it ever more difficult to get, and so people turned to methamphetamine. And cocaine itself came about because of the war on opium, and so on it goes. And you know, the war on methamphetamine has already given rise to even tougher drugs. I mean, wicked things called bath salts, which are created purely in the laboratory and are being imported from the UK. And these things are just dreadful, like one or two hits of them, and you're screwed up for life. So,
wow.
And why it is that some percentage of the population wants to take these things, beyond me, I don't know, but apparently it's a universal feature of human life. And I think from a from the point of view of humanitarianism and compassion, it's far better that safer drugs be available than ones that fry your brain after two uses. And that's what the war on drugs is driving us to. But let me just go back to the pseudoephedrine point. It's just stupid. I mean, the pseudoephedrine is a wonderful drug for unclogging your nose. Some people really depend on it, and the war on pseudoephedrine has had a lot of innocent casualties. Mm-hmm. And once again, denied us a decent medication, and it's only the beginning of the government regulations on medication. NyQuil doesn't work like it used to work. You can't even get children's medicine over the counter at all anymore. To get codeine cough syrup is
codeine's a big one.
Yeah, it's very difficult to get it. And you go to the doctor, you can on your knees and beg and pay egregious fees mm-hmm. just to see him. And then he prescribes you, you know, a couple of tablespoons and gives you a warning, you know.
Yeah. Here. Take this. Go. Get out of here.
And
unfortunately, this last segment's really short. We have about a minute and 40 seconds, so I'm just going to skip to our last point. And you ended with a quote by Joseph Schumpeter, and you have I'll give you about a minute to respond before we have to get out of here. But he said, the great tragedy of capitalism is that it produces riches so abundant that people tend to take them for granted, imagining they can hobble and destroy its productive machinery without great economic and social consequences. So please just give us your take on that quote.
Yeah, I couldn't really add to that. I mean, it's one of the terrible tragedies of human nature, or something, that everybody just takes our material blessings for granted. And you know, the goal of economic education is to get people to be sort of enlightened. You know, these things are not given to us by nature. The world in which we live is man-made, but men and women have to be free to make it. And that's the essence of the capitalist claim, and that's why it needs to be defended.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was a great interview, and I encourage our listeners to go back and use your economic knowledge and see how the various government regulations actually cause these things to come about with reference to shortages and things like that. So thank you, Jeffrey Tucker, Sir Lord Privy Jeffrey Tucker, for being
with
us today. This is Aaron Brown at Radio Free Market. Please visit us on the web at radiofreemarket.com, where you can subscribe for free to all of our shows on iTunes, or visit our Radio Free Market archives for easy downloads. And until next week, wherever you are, please stand up for freedom. Thank you for listening.